to the best of the 270s edition of Radio Freethinker. This flashback, is Islam the most violent religion? And how did Iraq become a failed state? Let's enter our time machine and go!
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks, but we are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are alert. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Today we are joined by host emeritus, Ethan Clow. Say hello, Ethan.
So, yeah, stopping by, of course, my current show, The Sector Podcast, is going strong. By now, episode 24 will be up, so check that out online, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And we've got some great content coming up in the next few weeks. We're looking to have with us a representative of Volunteer Canada, as well as an interview with the organization Women Moving Millions, which is all about the increasing financial philanthropic power of women across the world. So should be really fascinating couple of weeks. So tune in for that.
Well, congratulations on the number of shows. Keep going strong. Everything I know about it, it says it's a pretty good thing. We will eventually be discussing Islamophobia. And why are we doing that, you might ask? Well, recently there's been a major controversy in the liberal community. Can I say liberal community, Ethan?
Hold on, let me just double check the dictionary of liberalism and community. Yes, you may.
Okay, so before we get to that, spoiler alert, we're not fans of Sam Harris or Bill Maher on this. That comment will make more sense during the second part of our discussion. However, before we can take a stand on the controversy, we must first answer the question at the heart of it. Is Islam the most violent religion? Well, let us first say that we're not talking historically. I think Christianity has nailed that down with the whole war, reformation, slavery, the Inquisition. That said, historically, all religions have had, how shall we say, dark moments. Sam Harris makes the claim it is the most violent ever, but I shall steelman his argument.
So, Don, steelmanning, I haven't heard that term before.
Well, it's kind of the opposite of strawmanning. That is, I intend to take the most generous and strongest possible interpretation of Harris's argument. So the real question at hand, then, is Islam the most violent religion currently? To test the theory that Islam is the most violent religion, we need to sort of universalize the question. That is, globally, is Islam the source of the most violence? And to address the elephant in the room, ISIS, is the Middle East unique? Well, is its root cause Islam or not? Yes and no. At the moment, it is the hotbed of war, as Africa was in the 60s, Latin America in the 70s. For those who are unaware, the Middle East, sans Israel, was seen as a relatively stable part of the world if you go back a couple of decades. During the 1960s, when France and Britain were extricating themselves from their colonies in Africa, well, at that time, that was the hotbed of violence in the world. The violence was often racial in context, like duh, and led to waves of terrorist groups like the Algerian Liberation Front, Zimbabwe African National Union, and the African National Congress of South Africa. Many people forget that it was not until 2008 that Nelson Mandela was delisted as a terrorist by the U.S. government. Then in the 70s and 80s, you had the same thing happen to the very Catholic South and Central America. Of course, most of these movements were actually crushed thanks to heavy support of violent dictators by the U.S., and it was not really until the 90s that most of these nations made a transition to, more or less peacefully, to a kind of democracy. Your thoughts on this first part, Ethan?
Well, you're quite right about the situation in the Middle East compared to, say, Africa. And a really good example of this, if anyone wants to do some more research, is to look at France's issue with Algeria in the 1960s, where basically France was trying to cling on to Algeria while Algeria was basically trying to get away, led to some really violent incursions. And, you know, the one of the things people maybe not realize is that the whole Vietnam kerfuffle was started by France. And it was part of France's attempt to hang on to its dwindling empire in the 60s. So, I mean, it's pretty easy to forget that the violence perpetrated back then was like a good deal more extreme than what we have right now.
And you know, that particular instance is doubled down when you look at the Dutch in the Indonesia area where, what was it, East Timor and all that, right? Where, again, you had horrible oppressions, none of it really Muslim-related, perpetrated by Western democracies, couldn't quote, violently oppressing to the point of being state-sponsored terrorists of these groups.
Yeah, it was a really chaotic time. And the ironic thing about it, too, you know, coming off of World War II and the sort of makeshift alliance that the U.S. and Western Europe were building against the Soviet Union, you know, part of the reason to de-empire was that the U.S. was putting pressure on the European powers to, you know, be more democratic. Ironically, you know, in this case of France, after France said, okay, screw this, you know, F Vietnam, well, America was like, well, no, we can fix this. And so it's a little bit ironic that some lessons from history are still being repeated.
Yes. So with that historical context, we return to our question. If Islam was a violent religion, it should be more violent globally. And it's true that in the Middle East, it is sort of correlated. But outside of the Middle East, there doesn't really seem to be any correlation with Islam and violence. Let us not forget that Muslims are the subject of terrorism in Burma, that in Sri Lanka, the violence was between Buddhists and Hindus. The UK had Catholics versus Protestant terrorism, i.e. the IRA. The US's second worst terror attack was by a sovereign citizen type. Let's not forget Oklahoma. In fact, the vast majority of terrorist acts in the U.S. are done by white anti-government or racist groups. There are some examples of violence that we don't really seem to count that are done by Muslims. Let's not forget the, quote, freedom fighters that we had in Afghanistan during the 80s. And currently we seem to see the Uyghur fighters in China as more, again, freedom fighters against Chinese authoritarian communism. And then, of course, you get ones that are getting from both sides, like in the Kashmir, which is sort of fighting for independence from both Pakistan and India. Any thoughts on these particular current, you know, if they're fighting for us, they're freedom fighters. If they're fighting against us, they're terrorists.
Well, I mean, the point that you mentioned there, Don, about in America with the sort of the white radical violence causers, the weird dichotomy, of course, is that, you know, if a Muslim blows up a building, it's terrorism. If a white person does it, they're crazy. And I think it just adds to this kind of blindness that we have in society. And I think, unfortunately, you know, Sam Harris, Bill Maher, and his like, they either don't recognize this or they don't care. And they're just sort of happy to portray this as, you know, when someone in America blows something up, well, they're just insane. They're just lunatics. But as soon as it becomes a Muslim or any other nationality, it's terrorism. It's religiously motivated violence. And I think that that's pretty short-sighted.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of it, too, is on the reporting of such things, which I think we'll go into the second part of this, is Islamophobia a real thing or not? Because, again, you had the Norway massacre. Again, lone wolf, because he's a white Christian type guy. In the United States, there was this really crazy thing that happened in Georgia where you had, quote, right, white supremacists drive into one of the government buildings, guns a-blazing, right, in order to free America. And again, his whole past, the fact that there's a whole large ideology of internal insurrection, revolution over the government, violence towards the people, just seems to get whitewashed because they're whitewashed.
Yeah, quite literally. I mean, and I was actually just reading a really unbelievable story from American history of how in, I believe it was near Cincinnati, there was a massive racist riot that led to like an entire neighborhood being burned down. And this was back in the 20s or 30s. But basically, it was just written right out of the history books until very recently. And it was, I mean, it was like a massive terrorist attack by white people on this black community. It was unbelievable. And it, you know, it kind of goes to show you that history blindness that we're seeing in Sam Harris and Bill Maher, not recognizing what is real terrorism, totally absent of religion.
Okay, but let's keep our focus. Islam and violent uprising. Well, there are two areas we see outside of the Middle East where this is sort of happening, the Caucasus and Nigeria. I cannot help but note, or chuckle, the Caucasus is the root of Caucasian, i.e. white folks like you and me, Ethan, but I digress. Actually, it does bring up an important side note that we can address now as any time. Technically, Islamophobia is not racist, but racist-like. What do I mean by that? Well, technically, anyone who is a Muslim is subject to Islamophobia. But that not only includes the race, however defined, of Arab, but also black Africans, the Caucasus of southern former Soviet Union, the Gingers of Glasgow. Our language, I guess thankfully, doesn't actually have a term for social discrimination based on religious affiliations. You tend just to condemn the religious affiliation and not sort of the people behind it. Previously, we used to have something like Jews, where you could have had both religion and race subsumed into one. But that simply breaks down when you think about global Islam. So let's introduce our audience to a term, religionism, and the religionist. Think of the term as sort of anti-Semitic, but more accurately anti-Muslim, or let's go old-school anti-Mohammedan. But here we have an issue, and I'm sure we'll discuss it later, that often the anti-Mohammedan is saying anti-Islam, but is thinking, and let's be generous, feeling anti-Arab, or more cruder, anti-brown skin. So Islamophobia, like anti-Semitism, is kind of a cross between a hatred or a disdain for a race and a religion. I suspect that Nazis would not have cared if Sammy Davis Jr. was not of Semitic blood, but only that his beliefs were proven to be defective by their particular means. Any thoughts on this, Ethan?
Well, you know, Don, if you were phobia towards Christians, Jews, and Muslims, you'd be anti-Abrahamic?
Yes, that would be true.
And if you were, phobic against monotheistic religions, what would you be, anti-Zoroastrian Abrahamic?
And what if you were, you know, prejudiced against all religion, would you be, no, I won't go to the A word. Okay, so let's get back on track. There are three non-Middle Eastern areas of Islamic conflict. First, Europe. And if you're not a right-winger, I just surprised you. Often the condemnation of Islam, the protestation of Muslims in Europe, is brought up. Most cited the Danish cartoons and the inspiration for Blasphemy Day. First, I should point out that many immigrants are still immigrants after two or three generations. Unlike here in Canada, most European nations are very strict and reluctant to give full citizenship to, quote, foreign types. And thanks to the European equivalent of Mexican immigrants, most of these foreign people are Muslims. They also tend to be an underclass, the exploited working class. So the violence that erupts over the infamous cartoons had more to do with the sense of social inequality than religionism. Most did not really care that much about the cartoon per se, but saw it as another insult to their existence, more of a caste thing than anything else. That said, as an aside, there were religious radicals who were willing to take advantage of the underlying social grievances and use them to promote both their own profiles as well as their cause célèbre, like global jihad. Any thoughts about European Islamic threat?
Well, yeah, Don, I think you hit the nail on the head there with focusing on sort of the economic and class factors. And of course, you know, France is always the go-to example of this, where you have a really large population of young Muslim folk who are, you know, in a very low economic status. They don't really have a lot of representation in politics and society. And they're basically kind of ostracized as not being, you know, truly French. And of course, you know, France is one of those countries where that's a big issue if you don't blend into the rest of the society. And you're also seeing it represented in England, in the UK. And it's starting to show its face all over in Germany and the Scandinavian countries as well. Switzerland, the whole minarets thing. It's focusing in on a vulnerable population. And when you do that, you force them to become more insular, and you know, they start to look for anything that they can rally behind, and you know, religion is going to be one of those things.
And this becomes a very generational thing as well. Like this has happened before, where you grow up and you see there's something wrong with your society and you feel the urge to change it. And the urge to change it tends to be on whatever the cleavage is of the moment. I mean, in the 60s, you had racism as a big thing. In the 70s, there was the women's movement. And the fact that this seems to be a bit more violent is because the violence being inflicted, or the sort of the focus point, i.e. the Middle East, is much more violent. There wasn't that kind of violence going on in the 60s. There was a lot of violence locally, as we talked about with as far as local terrorism, but not in the same sort of global thing. And I think that's why you get a lot of these, what is the big fear now with radicalized people at home going to these countries to fight these religious wars?
Yeah, the sort of idea of like terrorism, tourism or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and if you're sitting there and you're at home and you're in Calgary, let's say, let's be generous, because I think France would be even worse, and, you know, you've got no roots, you've lost your job, maybe your girlfriend's gone, you're feeling a bit lost, and then someone says, hey, let me show you something nice. And there are all types that will do this. The neo-Nazis will do this, Islamists will do this, Christian proselytes do this. We never get really upset when we send missionaries over to Africa to teach people that gays should be killed or that this woman is a witch and we need to exorcise her, but they really get upset when they go over there to be, quote, freedom fighters from a perspective. In fact, I was just listening the other day that Holland is changing its laws to allow a biker gang to go to Kurdistan to fight ISIS, which goes against their traditional laws because, again, those are the good guys, and we want to help the good guys kill the bad guys, however you define that.
Well, yeah, I saw that story, too. It's pretty ridiculous. I mean, the thing that's important to remember with regards to that kind of indoctrination, it happens independent of religion. As you mentioned, like neo-Nazi groups, racist groups use that kind of method for bringing in new recruits. Cults use that for brainwashing people. There's nothing inherently religious about that.
Okay, returning to our question. Globally, Muslims are behaving badly in two areas, Nigeria and the Caucasus. Let's look at Nigeria. Boko Haram is a violent Muslim militia that has done bad things. We think currently about 200 or so girls that were abducted and used either as sex slaves or hostages. Regardless, they are violent terrorists, or more generously, insurgent group in Nigeria with the aims of making a religiously pure state. Not good, not defending them. But so is the Christian Kong. Quote, a militant movement that has described variously as being quasi-Christian, Christianist, or extremist Christian. And there are far more Christian groups like that in Africa. Remember, blood diamonds and child soldiers is not a Muslim thing, but an African thing. Actually more prevalent by Christian-type groups. So it seems not to be, again, an Islamic thing, but an African thing. The same could be said for female genital mutilation. Yes, FGM is very prevalent, almost universal in Muslim nations. But countries like Eritrea and maybe Ethiopia, those are actually majority Christian nations. 9 out of 10 of the countries that practice this in Africa are Muslim majority. That said, I would still say this is an African thing because outside of Africa, it's almost unheard of. Well, at least from the data that I could find, that if this was an inherent part of Islam, you would expect it being occurred in Afghanistan, in Indonesia, wherever Islam is, but it's only in this one particular local strip of Africa that it's happening, so I think you can give them a bit of a pass as far as Muslims being the source of it, as opposed to some historical African tradition that is the source of it. Do you have any thoughts on that, Ethan?
Well, I think it just goes to show sort of how culture and society will bleed into each other, and you will get kind of a merging of different views. You know, North Africa, one of the most diverse places in the world, you're going to get all kinds of different thoughts and philosophies merging together like this.
Yeah. Okay, so what about the Caucasus? Well, they're close enough to the Middle East and have a similar influence, imperial subjugation and Wahhabism. That's something I'm going to talk about later, but that I'm actually going to call them the same. I'm going to group them into the Middle East, although technically they're not part of it. Now, I know I'm moving rather quickly over the Caucasus. Do you think I'm being unfair in that, Ethan?
If I said yes, what would you do?
I'd ask why.
Well, then I'll say no.
Okay. Of course, you might ask about the Bali bombing, 9/11, 7/11, Boston Marathon. Well, yes, these were Muslim actors, but they were by and large lone wolves. In fact, in the U.S., there are exponentially more terrorist attacks perpetrated by sovereign citizen or white supremacists than any religious-related groups. Before we move on, thoughts about the lone wolf theory. Does it seem strange that any attack by an Arab, Muslim, or brown-skinned person is part of a global conspiracy? But if they're white, well, that's just a lone wolf, a crazy man like we saw in Norway. We've kind of already touched on this, Ethan. So you agree with this, obviously.
Yeah, I think we sort of talked about this at length. The interesting thing about this, too, is the way that we really sort of minimize the sort of homegrown terrorists into the crazy person or the relics of history. I mean, the large-scale terrorism that was enacted by white supremacists, all the way up to the 1960s, really, we have a tendency to kind of gloss over that and focus in on the one or two instances of, you know, a foreign national committing a terrorism act.
And I'd like to jump on the racist part. I would. I'd like to. I'd love to. But you did have the same sort of global conspiracy thing with the communists and all that. But I'm going to get into that later. Okay. But one must acknowledge that what is happening in the Middle East is, at least by modern standards, fairly extreme. Although common in Saudi Arabia, beheading is vis-a-vis terrorism sort of an Islamic development. Let's not forget Daniel Perelman's beheading in Pakistan in 2002. Beyond that, there is sort of this ongoing ethnic thinning, or if not ethnic cleansing, in the region. However, this too is not really unique to the area. Such things have happened in Africa, let's remember Rwanda. Let's not forget the breakup of Yugoslavia. But Islam is not the only innovators of terror. One thing brought up as condemnation, and justly, the action of these groups to use rape as a terror weapon, or sex slavery. The modern incarnation of this practice first emerged not in a Muslim country, but Rwanda, an overwhelmingly Christian nation. And I don't mean soldiers running amok, that's been going on for as long as humans have been around, but sort of a systematic use of rape to destroy the community. I'm sure there are other social disgraces that have been used to demoralize the, quote, other side. Do you think this is uniquely Islamic?
Well, you know, I don't think so. And some of the research that comes out of organizations like the UN or the World Health Organization, they suggest that, you know, sex slavery and trafficking of human beings is not uniquely Islamic. In fact, it appears to be going on all over the world, in Russia, in Asia, India, Africa, South America. And indeed, we're not immune to this in North America either. It happens here as well. So, again, I think that we need to take off the sunglasses when we look at, you know, the West and start to see some of the problems are existing here as well.
But I do think, though, that there is something going on here. And that, in fact, that this region has been a active war zone for years, decades if you count the Saddam years. We worry about soldiers who spend a few months over there who are so traumatized that they're no longer able to function. If PTSD affects them in a few months, what dire effects does it have on someone who's grown up in this environment? This is one point that I think supports the, this is uniquely bad, but is it Islamic? Well, there is one thread I did find that does sort of tie this all together as an Islamic plot of sorts, and this brings us back to those beheadings. Saudi Arabia has part of its legal system beheading. This is unique in the world. A couple of states sort of have beheadings on the books, but something they no longer practice. It's estimated that about 60 people have had their heads removed this year alone. Now, a bit of a confession here. Most of the sources I could find refer to these as executions, whether they are all or just some are done as beheadings. I can't actually say for sure, but I can say that definitely some have been beheadings. Another thing that ties almost all the extreme violent Islamic groups, and I dare say Muslim individuals, is that they have all been heavily influenced by the Wahhabi sect of Islam, the one that is supported and funded by the Saudi government and moneyed elite. Side note, the relationship between Wahhabi and the Saudi royal family is important. When Saad bin al-Saad unified the peninsula, he needed some form of traditional support in order to do this. The Wahhabis agreed to sort of provide the religious authenticity to the king in exchange for state support. This leads to a fuzzy but real correlation of Saad support as a cover term for Wahhabi proselytization. Now, there is a historical parallel. First, Saudi missionaries and money have been looking for opportunities to spread in the world. often places in conflict are actually the best place to sort of find new recruits. The parallel I would make here is to the Soviet Union. They would often offer support to struggling groups around the world, and because of this social political situation on the ground, i.e. living under a U.S.-supported dictatorship, these often resulted in violence and occasional revolution. There, of course, was a parallel, one where the U.S. supported death squads in places like El Salvador and Nicaragua. Was that a plot or political opportunism? But let's stick with the politically correct Soviet drive to take over the world. It works better for my argument. So on the one hand, you do have a kind of global conspiracy, but not of socialism or even communism. Those people who believed in that system were very peaceful in, quote, settled areas like Canada, the UK, excluding, of course, some lone wolves. Now, the violence only arose in places where oppression and social turmoil already existed. Did the outside players, Saudi or Soviets, play a role in sparking a fire in fertile ground? Yes, but it was only a sect of the larger, communist and Muslim, not the movement as a whole. Unlike the Soviet Union, the Wahhabis are not preaching social justice, equality, at least beyond what serves their propagandic purpose. They're preaching sort of slavery to religion. Sorry, I still think religion is innately wrong. What else did you exactly expect them to say? But I think the threat is still there, that you have these opportunistic players who are sort of plotting, but they're plotting for their own narrow purposes, and they're not representative of the larger whole. That said, do you have any comments, Ethan?
I think that pretty uniquely sums up what the situation is. In terms of the, you have radicals and you have people who see an opportunity to enhance their own power base. And they're going to use whatever instances they have at their disposal to get that power base. You know, the Soviet Union is a good example of that. So, again, I think this is another area where people like Sam Harris and Bill Maher totally overlook and miss the sort of wider context and the nuance of the situations that go into why we have this kind of violence erupting in different parts of the world.
So let's return to our original question. On the evidence we have presented, could one make the argument that Islam is worse than any other religion? Well, maybe parts are sects, but only by degree and not of kind. Let us not forget the aggressive work of evangelical Pentecostal Christians have done to make homosexuality a capital offense in Africa. They're working on bringing back witchcraft as a thing, like we're not past the 14th century. To make it extreme, saying all Islam is the worst because of Wahhabism is very bad would be like saying all Christianity is the worst because of the Westboro Baptist Church. That's the God hates fags people. And I think that's just crazy.
Yeah, I agree.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the downtown area at
The Baker and the Chef, Bang On T-shirts, Beat Street Records, Dunlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save On Meats, and Vinyl Records.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
And we're back. Okay, today we're going to do a little bit of a history lesson. A loyal listener to Radio Freethinker asked me if it was true that the U.S. sold weapons of mass destruction, or WMDs, to Iraq, and that it was because Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, possibly including nuclear ones. Well, this was the justification for the Iraq War, or the Second Gulf War. They then asked if it was true that the U.S. did not actually find any WMDs in Iraq, that the U.S. government knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, and the whole basis for the war was fraudulent, based on lies. They then asked why was everyone so upset with Bill Clinton getting a blowjob, but no one seemed enraged about Bush lying his way into the Iraq War. Well, there is sort of a lot there, and some of it kind of contradictory. So I thought I would do a little of sort of everything you need to know about Iraq. And warning, this will make you a little angry and probably a little depressed. Let's explore the whole history of Iraq and how that contributes to today's current quagmire. So let's start at the beginning. And don't worry, we'll be using a sort of wide brush to start with and become more focused as we approach our current time, so no one should fall asleep. In the beginning there was man, and he was good.
Of course, there was also women, and she was equally as good. Well, as these people began to settle down, homes evolved into states and families into civilizations. This was first achieved, well, no, evolved, in Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is the land between the two rivers. That's the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Modern-day Iraq, plus or minus a few bits. I say first, but to be fair, like in biology, sociology seems to have a sort of a convergence evolution. That is, the same trait evolves independently in different parts of the world. So civilization evolved around 6500 BC, or almost 9,000 years ago, in the Sumerian city-states of Mesopotamia, but also evolved along the Nile around the same time, as well as in the Indus cultures dating back to about 3000 BC, and China makes the claim for the first of its dynasties around 2000 BC. This is not to say that there were not people living together in large groups, but this is where we sort of slip from prehistoric to historic history. That is, historians correlate sort of the birth of civilization with the ability to write about it. This is why in the Americas, their civilization seems to have evolved relatively recently, about 1000 BC. And that's not because there are no evidence for complex society. For example, there were buildings in Peru dating back to 3500 BC. It's just that they didn't like to talk about themselves and thus are sort of placed in that secondary class of cultural evolution. But I digress. So after the Sumerians, Iraq was the center of many famous civilizations, notably the Babylonians and the Assyrian Empire. It's the birthplace of law. Think of Hammurabi's Code. And then you have the epics of Gilgamesh, set and written in the earliest part of Iraq, if I may use that term in this context. Many scholars believe the epic of Gilgamesh, written around 28 BC, are the roots of the Abrahamic faith, which didn't get their start until 1,000 years later. When Iraqi thinks of its history, they can go back almost farther back than anyone else and know that the influence they have had on the evolution of Western civilization is extreme. That said, the independent glory of Iraq was lost for many hundreds of years and only really returned with the invasion of the Mohammedans. It was under Islamic rule that Baghdad, in particular, entered a second golden age as sort of the brains of the Islamic world, being the center place for literature, science, and academia. This golden age came to a crashing end with the sacking of Baghdad by the Mongols. Ever since, this piece of land has found itself sort of the chew toy fought over between the rulers of Persia and the Ottomans. I'm going to stop here and point out that not all Muslims are the same, and that Iraq, being a focal point of civilization, has a complex religious and ethnic makeup. Now, some of us may be old enough to remember this song.
By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yeah, we wept when we remembered Zion. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yeah, we wept when we remembered Zion. Let the wicked carry us away in captivity, required from us the song. Now how shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land?
This is significant because Abraham, the inventor of Judaism, of course, Judaism evolved into Christianity, which in turn mutated into Islam. Well, so all of these religions are referred to as sort of the Abrahamic religion because they all trace back their roots to Abraham. So anyhow, Abraham left Ur. Ur was a city-state and sort of the forerunner of Babylon. He then went on to Canaan and founded both the Jewish faith and the nation of Israel. Now, I did say this was pre-Babylon. But the song, it goes,
by the rivers of Babylon.
It's making reference to Babylon. Well, this is a reference to the first diaspora of Jews who were taken away from what we would call Israel and taken to Babylon, largely as slaves, or something like that. I mean, it's all based on the Bible, which is all basically fiction. But the point being that there is, well, was, I think today, a small but historically deep Jewish population in Iraq. Of course, adding to this is the spread of Christianity at the spear point of the Romans. In particular, Assyria became a major center for Christian faith. Then, of course, you have the major sectarian cleavage which is between the Sunnis and the Shiites. Islam actually has many sects, much like Christianity. You know, you think Southern Baptist, Unitarians, Anglicans, Quakers, you kind of get the idea. That said, in Christianity, there is sort of one major dividing line. That's between the Catholics and the Protestants. Well, although effectively the same thing, but of course completely different, you find a similar major divide in Islam, ergo the Sunni-Shiite split. The technical reason for the split was a disagreement over who was the rightful successor to Muhammad. The Sunnis backed Abu Bakr, the father of Muhammad's wife, while the Shiites thought that Muhammad divinely ordained his cousin and son-in-law, Ali. That said, there are some theological differences. The Sunnis believe in the five pillars of Islam. Think of this as sort of the equivalent to the traditional Catholic or Latin Bible. Now, the Shiites accept this, but they also have the, quote, roots of religion and the branches of religion as also foundational to their text. If I'm going to keep my parallels with Christianity sort of together, one might think of this as sort of the difference between the Latin Bible versus the King James Bible. Although, it take with it as you can. So I'm going to sort of skip the details, and the point being is that you have two extremely similar, at least to outsiders, faith. Well, those who practice said faith see the differences as stark as night and day. This sectarianism is one of the major sources of conflict in the region. That said, these tensions have been more or less balanced and controlled by strong, often foreign, rulers. The modern history of Iraq begins with it gaining its independence from the Ottomans at the end of World War I, only to find themselves a, quote, protectorate of the British Empire. It was under this rule that the tried and true practice of colonial Britain, that of elevating a minority to rule a majority, making the minority dependent on the colonial power, while leaving the colonial power to provide basically minor support as they allow the minority group to do sort of the heavy lifting of imperial subjugation of the majority population. This is why in these areas of majority Shia populations that Sunni-led governments were propped up. This over-exasperated the underlying historical tensions, leading to overt and outright hostility and violence to the sectarian divide. It was the British who revived the militia system in Iraq. These militias were independent of the government and were sort of puppets of the British. That said, these militias were also the main mechanism for ethnic groups to protect themselves. Iraq was ruled by a royal family until a military coup. Well, to be fair, it was sort of a series of coups that ultimately led to the elevation of the Ba'athist Party, which essentially turned Iraq into a one-party state. It was during the instability of the military leadership coup period that Kuwait gained independence from Britain, something Iraq has rejected from the start. Iraq sees Kuwait as sort of an integral part of its nation. The Ba'athists were, a largely secular pan-Arab anti-colonial party. Pan-Arabism was a brief movement in the 60s and 70s led by Nasser of Egypt as sort of an attempt to unite all Arab nations in a single confederation. Iraq was one of the pawns used by the Soviets and the Americans in the Cold War. The ties between the Soviet Union were variable. At one point, Iraq was part of COMECON, Council of Mutual Economic Assistance, that was ground 1941 to 1991. It was kind of an economic trade union composed of communist Eastern Bloc countries. They received large investments in military support during the early 70s. That said, the Ba'athists also persecuted the Iraqi Communist Party, on and off. But this, as well as increased economic independence thanks to increasing oil revenue, or put another way, less dependence on Soviet investment in arms, made the link between Iraq and the Soviet world tenuous at best. When in 1979 the Shah of Iran, a loyal U.S. ally, was deposed in the Iranian Revolution, well, Saddam took the opportunity sort of to flip sides and became part of the American sphere of influence. The current strife in Iraq region can mainly, in my humble opinion, be traced back to the Iraq-Iran War. Now those who know their history of the region will be asking, which Iraq-Iran War am I referring to? If you look at a map of Iraq, you see that there is a little slip of land that touches the Gulf of Arabia. This is the main route that Iraq has for trading its goods. It's also a major and important thoroughfare for Iran. In modern times, this area, containing the river Arvandrud, has been fought over between Iran and Iraq many times. Well, I say modern times. The Ottomans were fighting over this slip of land as early as the 16th century. As part of this dispute, the province of Khuzestan, or as the Iraqis call it, Arabistan, became part of Iran. This, of course, much to the consternation of Iraq. Also, as part of the dispute, Iran was forced to pay a high toll for the use of the Arvan Round waterways. This led to an ill-fated Iran-Iraq war in 1974, which Iraq lost and was forced to sign a humiliating treaty called the Algerian Accord in 1975. Because of this, and with the newfound wealth from oil exports, Saddam, who is now firmly entrenched as the leader of Iraq, resolved that Iraq would never be humiliated again and began a huge military buildup. By 1988, some sources ranked Iraq's army fourth largest in the world. When the Shah of Iran was toppled, and there was much chaos in Iran, Saddam believed he saw an opportunity to right historical wrongs and attack Iran. It was also largely believed that such an attack was strongly supported by the Americans as a way of sort of getting back at Iran for the hostage situation. This led to the Iran-Iraq War of 1980, which lasted until 1988, where both sides basically gave up in exhaustion. This war, beyond a death toll in the millions, was also notable because it was the first major conflict that saw the return of chemical weapons used by Iraq against the Iranians. Now, the weapons were not provided by the U.S. government directly. In fact, most of the material for them came from European businesses. That said, the U.S. knew that Saddam was using them, that this was a violation of international law and warranted the designation of a war crime. They were complacent as well because the chemical weapons would not have been made available to Iraq without U.S. covert, if not overt, consent. Beyond that, the Reagan administration provided logistical and targeting information to help the Iraqi war effort, full in the knowledge that such info was being used to direct chemical weapon attacks. I think, if we return to our original question, the U.S. did not supply Iraq with weapons of mass destruction, of which chemical weapons qualify, but they did approve of their supply and actively helped in their use. So although not technically true, it is true. Now, a side effect of this war was the destruction of the Iraqi economy, because one thing the Iranians managed to do was to decimate Iraq's ability to export oil. Couple that with a drop in oil prices, Iraq was saddled with a huge debt, about $80 billion. Because Saddam thought that he was not only battling to promote Iraqi territorial efforts, but was also fighting to help the Sunni Arab nations, that by defeating or at least weakening the Shiite Iran, a nation actively trying to promote revolution in nations like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, that they were defending all Sunni nations. Saddam seemed to believe that his nation would supply the manpower, while other nations would help finance the war. I mentioned Kuwait because a large part of Iraq's debt was held by Kuwait. Saddam expected Kuwait to forgive that debt as Kuwait's contribution to the, what I shall call the Sunni-Shiite War. Oddly, Kuwait did not see things this way. This led Iraq, from its perspective, reclaiming its wayward province of Kuwait by invading in 1990. Now, this invasion was not a surprise, as Iraq was making signals that if Kuwait did not forgive its debt, it would invade. To this end, the U.S. government stated it would take a neutral stance on the situation, and more specifically, the American ambassador declared to the Iraqi interlocutor that, quote, Washington, inspired by friendship and not by confrontation, does not have an opinion on the disagreement between Kuwait and Iraq, stating that we have no opinion on Arab-Arab conflicts. The ambassador also let Saddam Hussein know that the United States did not intend to start an economic war against Iraq. Thus, I am sure Saddam was quite surprised when Bush Sr. rallied a coalition and started the first Gulf War. Part of the reason for this U.S. action was one of the greatest examples of propaganda ever, where you have a congressional committee hearing about the atrocities that the Iraqi army was doing. Let's listen in.
Thank you very much. Our final witness is also using an assumed name, and again, we ask our friends in the media to respect the need to for her to protect her family. And we finally call on Naira to testify.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Naira, and I just came out of Kuwait.
Okay.
My mother and I were in Kuwait on August 2nd for a peaceful summer holiday. My older sister had a baby on July 29th, and we wanted to spend some time in Kuwait with her. I only pray that none of my 10th grade classmates had a summer vacation like I did. I may have wished sometime that I could be an adult, that I could grow up quickly. What I saw happen to the children of Kuwait and to my country has changed my life forever. It has changed the life of all Kuwaitis, young and old. We are children no more. My sister, with my five-day-old nephew, traveled across the desert to safety. There is no milk available for the baby in Kuwait. They barely escaped when their car was stuck in the desert sand, and help came from Saudi Arabia. I stayed behind and wanted to do something for my country. The second week after I invaded, I volunteered at the Al-Adan Hospital with 12 other women who wanted to help as well. I was the youngest volunteer. The other women were from 20 to 30 years old. While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
Now, that does sound horrific. An unbelievable act of brutality. And actually, it kind of was unbelievable. In fact, the innocent girl testifying was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador, who was nowhere near Kuwait during or after the invasion. The incident related was complete fiction, but it did play its part in pushing the U.S. into war. So after the shellacking the Iraq army took in the Gulf War and the international sanctions, well, Iraq, which was one of the more well-developed parts of the Arab nation, was quickly digressing into sort of a Stone Age state. This situation was exacerbated as the U.S. tried to destabilize the Saddam regime by helping Islamic extremists. These groups saw Saddam as too secular, which he was. Although during the 90s, in an effort to sort of help prop up his regime and gain sympathy in the Arab world, he did start wrapping himself more and more as a defender of the faith against the evil imperialist American Western powers. There was a growing use of religious imagery in Iraq to prove its religious bona fides, in spite of the fact that the Baathists were still largely a secular party. Now, the lead up to the Second Gulf War saw a lot of weird things happen. So first, did Iraq have weapons of mass destruction? Well, yes, as in that there was likely some leftover stock of chemical weapons from the Iran-Iraq War, although most of this was well past its best before date. There was also a long-standing belief that Saddam was trying to produce chemical, biological, and or nuclear weapons. The UN had inspectors in Iraq since the first Gulf War. These inspectors did uncover attempts by Iraq, at least early on, of trying to produce biological and chemical weapons, efforts that had been abandoned and were never really a threat. In fact, the chief inspector of the UN, Scott Ritter, a former U.S. military advisor and Fox News contributor, hardly a softie on this issue, stated that,
"When you ask the question, does Iraq pose military viable biological or chemical weapons? The answer is no, and a resounding no. Can Iraq produce today chemical weapons on a meaningful scale? No. Can Iraq produce biological weapons on a meaningful scale? No. Ballistic missiles? No. It is no across the board. So from a qualitative standpoint, Iraq has been disarmed. Iraq today possesses no meaningful weapons of mass destruction capability."
Okay, that said, Saddam, as sort of a point of principle and as a sort of negotiating tool to try and lift sanctions, didn't make the UN's job easy. That said, 98% of all inspection activity occurred with complete Iraqi cooperation. And the Iraqi officials claimed the resistance only occurred when inspections involved the security procedures around Saddam Hussein, a target by the CIA. It was also an open secret that the U.S. spies were members of the inspection teams. It was this supposed refusal to allow inspections, which was not completely true, that became the casus belli of the war, at first anyway. It is funny, in the U.S. legislation authorizing military action, the only references to weapons of mass destruction was with regards to Saddam's willingness to use them on his own people, and not that Iraq was any sort of threat to the U.S. security. If you were in a crowd at the Republican convention in 2004, you would have noticed that every time 9/11 was mentioned, you would have also heard Saddam or Iraq mentioned. There is a willful effort to conflate the two. To this day, 60% of Americans think that Saddam was somehow responsible for 9/11. When pressed, the official line was Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. But the conflation of the two continued, along with the attempts to connect Saddam with global terrorism in general. This was also discredited by academics that point out that one of the major threats to Saddam's regime was fundamentalist Islam, as that was a force actively trying to overthrow the Ba'athist regime. Now, it is true that Saddam supported the Palestinian cause, and this included paying a sort of life insurance for Palestinian suicide bombers. But this had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, which was a constant innuendo of the Bush administration. There is, of course, the famous Yellow Cake speech made by Colin Powell to the UN, where he claimed that there was undeniable evidence that Saddam was trying to acquire Yellow Cake. That's the natural occurring form of uranium, from which weapon-grade uranium could be extracted. It was known prior to his testimony, at least in the intelligence community and the alternative media who reported on this, well, that the Yellow Cake story was a complete fabrication, a pure fiction. There was also claims that Saddam had portable biological weapons factories and other evidence of his attempts to procure weapons of mass destruction, with Condoleezza Rice summing it up, saying that we don't want the evidence being a mushroom cloud. As it turned out, there are no weapons of mass destruction, and that the administration largely knew that this was the case, that they actively attempted to persuade Americans that the only thing that can be done, that the U.S. must attack and remove Saddam from Iraq before he destroys the U.S. Was this a conspiracy? Likely. That said, a lot of blame was laid at the feet of confirmation bias and wishful thinking, that any statement made by a supposed witness was assumed true if it supported the let's invade argument. We can remember the infamous informant, Curveball, what an appropriate code name, that this source just made shit up. Once it became clear that there were no weapons of mass destruction, the Bush administration changed their justification for the war by claiming it was a humanitarian and that the goal was to liberate Iraq. Now, I and many others have implied that there was a conspiracy to invade Iraq. Why would Bush wish to do this? Well, some say it was personal, that Saddam apparently sponsored a failed assassination attempt on Bush Sr. in the 90s. Maybe. But why would the rest of the government go along on such a personal vendetta? Iraq does have the world's fifth largest proven oil reserves, so some claim that the real aim was to secure Iraqi oil for Exxon and the like. Well, that may be true, and the American government is largely under the control of corporate interests. The ties between the oil giant Halliburton and then Vice President Dick Cheney make this opinion, if not absolutely true, it does seem that it was highly influential in the decision-making. My own conspiracy theory is the military-industrial complex was the driving force behind the Iraq war. That is, war is very profitable. The cost of one cruise missile is $1 to $2 million. And after 9/11, the Afghan war, U.S. corporations quickly realized that this was one issue that the U.S. government was willing to spend an unlimited amount of money with nominal oversight. By nominal oversight, I mean that they were throwing money at projects irrespective of that project's likelihood of success. A great example of this is the homeopathic bomb detector the U.S. and the Iraqi government, with U.S. money, bought. A detector that was a reworked novelty golf ball detector. And by novelty, I mean like the X-ray glasses you find in the back of comic books. Halliburton, now called KBR, was paid almost $40 billion to maintain a U.S. military base in Iraq, a job it's done so shoddily that it has earned universal criticism from everyone, including the military. Let's not forget the $6 billion that just got lost in Baghdad, just went poof. And as well, let us not forget, it is thanks to the Afghan and Iraq wars that the entire drone industry came into its own. Whether the U.S. was lied into war or not, that's unimportant. The U.S. invaded. But unlike the first Gulf War, where almost a million troops were used, this second war was executed under the Rumsfeld Doctrine. The Rumsfeld Doctrine relied heavily on U.S. technical superiority. Thus, the Second Gulf War saw a U.S. invasion force of less than 150,000 troops. A combined coalition force only numbered about 200,000. That number increases to about 300,000 if you include like the Kurdish insurgents and the like. Rumsfeld gambled, and successfully, that if the U.S. used its shock and awe factor, its overwhelming technical superiority, it could quickly defeat the Iraqi military. And he was right. The war was over in 21 days. What Rumsfeld seems to have failed to take into consideration is the occupation of Iraq, which officially lasted almost 9 years. But if U.S. forces are drawn back into Iraq, as seems likely over the ISIS affair, well, that tale seems still to be continuing. But the trouble occupying with such a small force has become obvious. Iraq is small by Canadian standards, but it's still a large nation, larger than Texas and California combined, and a population greater than that of Canada. There are just not enough soldiers to control Iraq. You might say, well, there were still the police and the like. Even if Saddam was gone, the government still persisted. Well, no. In another self-defeating act, the first thing the U.S. did was to de-bathify Iraq. This meant that anyone who was a member of the Ba'ath Party was essentially fired. This meant that pretty much all of the military, civil servants, the government in general was gone. Not only gone, but forbidden to ever participate in government and military education again. Remember, this was a one-party state controlled by a brutal dictator. Everyone, whether you wanted to be or not, was a member of the party. This essentially put Iraq into a lawless state. This is when you have the rise of the militias. The militias, based on ethnic, tribal, or sectarian ties, stepped into the vacuum created by the American sanctions. If we remember, militias have a long history in Iraq. This, of course, meant that minor historical divides emerged, that slights by one group were met by sort of an eye-for-an-eye type of justice. Of course, the U.S. oversaw the reconstruction of the Iraq government, but again, thanks to the de-Ba'athification and the fact that the Shiite majority were historically against the now-defunct Saddam regime, well, the Iraqi government, the Iraqi military, the Iraqi security forces were really the Shiite government, military, etc. This is one of the reasons that the major divides in Iraq are along sectarian lines, mainly Shiite-Sunni. But as we are seeing with ISIS, internal divides between sects of Sunniism and Shiitism are creating the borders of this divided former nation. We're still too close to the time of the war to know for sure how history will judge this debacle. That said, the current rise of ISIS, the civil war in Syria, the ethnic cleansing of the West Bank, the general rise of radical Islam can largely be seen as at least being amplified, if not instigated, by the U.S. policy to Iraq. Oh yes, and one final note. Were people really upset about Bush's lying to the about the Iraq war versus Bill Clinton's blowjob? Well, it depends on who you were listening to. If you were listening to the mainstream media, yes, there was a huge difference. It seems like Bill Clinton was definitely vilified and seen as a very bad person. And Bush, well, Bush, I guess the worst that he seemed to get in the mainstream media was he was either ill-advised or controlled by evil Cheney or wasn't just smart enough to know better. That being said, if you were listening to the alternative media, things like Democracy Now!, the Real News Network, and of course, Radio Free Thinker, those places were sitting there saying, hey, this is the truth, you're being lied to. Why are you doing this? And we may not remember this, but in the lead up to the Iraq War, we saw some of the largest protests against the war, numbering well over millions of people in all the major Western centers in the world. And yet, the war went on, and again, that plays more into my own military-industrial complex, the U.S. government owned by corporations, quasi-conspiracy theory. But I think that's all for this particular topic. Well, it's the last show of the year. We plan to start off the next year with the top 14 of 2014, the top 14 things that happened in the year. Please email us or leave a comment on our Facebook page about what you thought were the biggest events, stories, or what have you of 2014. This is Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist, saying eyes open, minds on, and have a very happy skeptical new year.